Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this episode of City Talks. Today, my guests are Jason Segedy. Jason is Director of Planning and Urban Development for the City of Akron, Ohio, and the Economic Innovation Group's First Legacy Cities Fellow. And Keenan Feckery. Keenan is Director of Research and Policy Development at the Economic Innovation Group. And before EIG, he was Senior Policy Analyst and Associate Fellow at Brookings Institute's Metro Policy Program. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
So we're going to focus on the Legacy Cities Program and what it's been doing and why it came about. So, Keenan, starting with you, just give us a sense as to why the Legacy Program was established by EIG, why it came about, what it is that you're hoping for it to achieve, and then we'll dive into the detail.
Yeah, thanks. So EIG, we're just about a six-year-old think tank here in DC dedicated to novel ideas and insights that help us forge a more dynamic and entrepreneurial economy all throughout the United States, with an emphasis there on all throughout the United States. So a lot of our research work is into geographic inequality and spatial inequality. And, you know, especially coming out of the recession, that recovery was more inequitable across places than anything that we had experienced ever prior. And it had completely inverted the 1990s pattern, where you had small rural counties, you had small cities, you had mid-sized cities like Akron, Ohio, leading national growth just two short decades ago. Whereas when we fast forwarded to the 2010s and the exit from the Great Recession, it was just dominated by the superstar cities that, you know, now we talk about a lot. But we were kind of forged in that mid-2010s period, when those trends were first becoming apparent. And we saw them as a huge problem that I think then the 2016 election kind of confirmed our hypothesis there. And, you know, one reason why we wanted to start the Legacy Cities Initiative is, in some of our early research, a key insight from the data, kind of merging place and our interest in startups and entrepreneurship, was that, you know, across the U.S. economy, either over time or across space, right? So back in time, across regions of the country, the rate at which firms close and die out is pretty constant. It's around 8% of all companies each year in every state and every metro area end up closing. But the real variable is the rate at which firms open. And here we saw in the legacy cities in the Rust Belt, the Great Lakes, and just part of the chronically lagging parts of the United States had extremely low rates of entrepreneurship, which kind of tips the problem statement when you're thinking about these regions on its head, right? It goes from, oh no, you know, trade killed everything, or, you know, automation is the reason why Ohio's struggling to, well, actually, maybe we weren't investing enough in kind of the facets of renewal and the kind of positioning these places to thrive when the next wave of economic change came. And that's kind of just idea that we went down that rabbit hole and thought, let's focus on, you know, how do you renew the economy in these places for, I think, a stronger just national polity, national economy, et cetera. Yeah, I'll leave it at that for now.
No, it's a great introduction. And part of it, I think you just said, was your recognition that in the US, you know, and obviously a very, very large country, the urban debate was often dominated by the coastal cities, which were very different than the heartlands. And you see some similarities, obviously, in the UK, which is that our urban policy debate is, you know, is influenced by, you know, by one section rather than the other. And actually a full appreciation is really where we need to get to. I think that's a really kind of interesting point that we need to, and policy is then generated with a certain view in mind rather than a fuller, rounder picture.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think especially now, and this is just kind of my own perspective, Jason may have a different one, but so much of the policy debate is focused on like how do you slow down change. And that's not necessarily what's going to best serve people in Sheffield or people in Rochester or Syracuse, New York. They need to be better positioned to deal with change and adapt. And that's kind of where we're trying to, as a group, kind of shift the narrative. And I think Jason's work has really helped us do that with a voice from the region. And similarly, I guess also touching on the national debate, which is dominated by the big coastal cities, like our whole urban policy discussion in the U.S. is essentially whatever Brooklyn cares about. today, which is not necessarily constructive for places like Akron and on. Jason's going to get into this more, but we thought that there was a need for this perspective, you know, rooted in these regions about what they need to thrive in the modern economy that we hope to advance. And we got a great spokesperson to help us with that.
Brilliant. So let's dive into the detail. And Jason, you know, you, I said in the introduction, obviously you are the inaugural Legacy Cities Fellow, but you're also Director of Planning and Urban Development at the City of Akron. You were born there, you raised there, you are from there, you want to see it thrive for a whole bunch of different reasons. So just take us through, I suppose, the history really of Akron, because I think the story of Akron is the story of Legacy Cities. And just before you do that, I just want to read out two brilliant stats that you use in your various publications. The first stat you say is in 1925, so this has gone back a while, nearly 100 years, Akron produced half of the tires on the planet. I think that's a kind of great, you know, it's a reminder of, you know, a huge industrial heritage and background. And then the other fantastic stat is you say a simple comparison between the metropolitan Cleveland and Washington, D.C. shows what a Ohio cities are up against. In 1960, median household income in Washington, D.C. was 9% higher than Cleveland. Cleveland is one of the big urban areas in the state of Ohio. In 2018, median household income in Washington, D.C. was 82% higher than it was in Cleveland. So this kind of huge but quite rapid divergence of some of our urban areas that not so long ago, you know, were much closer together. So just unpack Akron for us and tell us, you know, tell us what that tells us about the broader story about our legacy cities.
Sure. So I really do think that Akron, you know, it is kind of the quintessential mid-sized city. And I think in many ways, it is the quintessential legacy city. I think it's a good illustrative example of what's happened in a lot of places. You know, many of the trends that have happened here, I think, are very similar to, say, Detroit. You know, some of the details are slightly different, but I think most listeners are probably pretty familiar with the story of a place like Detroit. So just quickly about Akron, you know, this was a pretty small town for a long time. We grew up actually as a canal town. So the city was founded in 1825. So we're getting close to our bicentennial now. And the city grew and developed as a stop on the Ohio and Erie Canal, which connected the Great Lakes, Lake Erie, with the Ohio River. And really until about 1870 or so, it was a small place. I think we had like 10,000 people in 1870. And that was when B.F. Goodrich opened the first rubber factory here. And, you know, people ask a lot, like, why did the rubber industry center on Akron? Like, it's certainly not because we have rubber trees or anything here. But it was kind of an accident of history. He came from New York and it opened the first rubber factory that was west of the Appalachian Mountains. And like a lot of industries, there was just that agglomeration effect of know-how and other entrepreneurs. And so by 1900, you know, we quickly became the global center for rubber manufacturing. We had the headquarters of Goodyear, Firestone, B.F. Goodrich, and General Tire, which were four of the five largest rubber companies on the planet. We specialized in tires, but we made every rubber product known to man pretty much. So there were, you know, a lot of chemical plants, a lot of other rubber products being manufactured here. We went from 69,000 people in 1910 to 208,000 people in 1920. So we were actually the fastest growing larger city in the United States that decade. In many ways, and I think this is the linkage to some of the things that Kenan was talking about, you know, we were in a way like the Silicon Valley of that era. We were the place everybody was moving. You know, we attracted many European immigrants, many domestic migrants from Appalachia and from the South. And so the city really kind of became this melting pot of, you know, European immigrants, white Southerners from Appalachia, and Black Southerners from farther in the South. And, you know, many of these cities were very diverse and cosmopolitan places in their day. And so I think that's another analog to, you know, some of the coastal superstar cities today. And just to wrap up the history quickly, what happened was, you know, what happened in a lot of American industrial cities, and, you know, as well as you mentioned, Andrew, cities in the north of England, where a lot of these legacy industries started falling prey to either globalization or just, you know, domestic relocation. You know, in the United States, a lot of industry moved from the north to the south. We were a very heavily unionized, one of the most heavily unionized cities in the country, and to reduce labor costs or get out of outmoded plants. And not that the deindustrialization caused every problem here, but it was a hugely significant factor. And I think my personal connection to that is, you know, many of my older relatives worked in rubber plants. That's what brought my great-grandfather to Akron. He was a Hungarian immigrant and ended up working at Firestone. My grandfather worked at Firestone. My uncle worked at B.F. Goodrich. And I was born in the early 1970s. So my lifetime has kind of coincided with, you know, from my earliest memories of all those factories shutting down and people losing their jobs. And so I think that's always, on a personal note, given me a lot of, you know, emotional connection to what happened here. And I've really kind of tried to shape my career around doing what I can to try to help, you know, the city through this transition and look to the future for being, you know, a place that people can thrive and not just survive.
For our listeners, Akron now is a city of population of around 200,000. Is that right? Come down from a peak of about 280. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Our peak was real close to that 290 in 1960, and we're just a shade under 200,000. We'll see what the census says. I think we've gotten to where I suspect we will lose very few people this past decade. I think we're close to quote unquote bottoming out now.
And just put it in the context of Ohio, because what, in a sense, you also look at, you know, it's not just Akron, but you're actually looking at a broader suite of places, many of them, you know, Cleveland and Cincinnati and others, all of Columbus, all of them, you know, in Ohio, which tell us similar but sometimes different stories as well. So just locate Akron in the Ohio state.
Sure. So Ohio, you know, despite a lot of stagnation over the last, really my whole lifetime, the last five decades, it's still the seventh largest state in the U.S. We've got just under 12 million people here. There are a lot of cities here, a lot of mid-sized and larger cities. I think what's interesting about Akron and this part of the state, we're in the northeast part of the state. And, you know, in addition to the 200,000 people in the city, we're really part of a larger metro region that includes Cleveland and Canton and Youngstown that all told has close to 4 million residents. You know, within about 50 miles of here, there are 4 million people. So I always remind people, you know, this is still one of the largest urban regions in the United States, despite a lot of the, you know, stagnation, both the population and of the economy.
We'll get to sort of where the thinking is now in terms of the sort of policy responses to the challenges that we, you know, that we see and the opportunities that we see in legacy cities and, you know, post-industrial cities. But just going back through that period where, you know, deindustrialization was beginning to quicken, relocation away to wherever else was beginning to quicken. I mean, Jason, it's part of the policy. We saw this in the UK. To what extent was policy trying to hold back the tide? In a sense, you know, it was trying to resist the change that was there, trying to hold on to what, you know, what it previously had. I mean, what was that part of the story in the way that policy responded? Not now, because I think policy has moved on, but if you could characterize policy through the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I mean, is that a fair characterization or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. And there were some different currents, I think, in public policy discussion from, you know, what I've read and started to be old enough to remember if we get into, say, the 80s. But one thing that was interesting in Akron, which wasn't necessarily what happened in other places more recently, is our rubber industry collapse wasn't primarily due to globalization or trade. It really was more of a relocation domestically of plants to newer, more efficient plants with cheaper labor in the South. Although it is true that you know, three of our four rubber companies were bought up ultimately by foreign firms. So, you know, Bridgestone in Japan took over Firestone, et cetera. But in our deindustrialization was a little earlier than, say, the next wave that I think started to happen more in the late 90s and the 2000s in places like Dayton or Toledo and some other Ohio cities. So I think on the policy front, you know, this is maybe more of a cultural or sociological component of that, but in this part of the country, and I'm not ashamed of the term Rust Belt, so I'll go ahead and use it, but in the Rust Belt, I think for a long, long time, and it just started changing maybe 10 years ago, I would say, with the older generations that really lived through that time as full-fledged adults, there was a lot of discussion about how do we get all of the industry back, or maybe a sense of denial or hopelessness that it's gone and there's nothing we can do. You know, there were a variety of different reactions, but I think you saw some of that even more recently manifested in, say, when President Trump would come to a place like Ohio and say, you know, we're going to bring those jobs back. And I think that idea of the jobs coming back, it's lost some resonance now, but I would say, and I'll end on this, and Kenan might have thoughts on this, but I, despite all of that, I do think it's a mistake to just assume these places can never have industry again. But what that looks like and what type of industry, I think that's a really open question that smarter people than me might have the answer to, but I think that book hasn't been written yet.
That's a great point. Kenan, you come in on that and just, you know, reflections on, I suppose, past attempts to policy attempts to try and deal with, you know, the issues, you know, that we see in Rust Belt cities or post-industrial cities, where, you know, the term that you wish.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the policy response has been particularly robust or particularly smart. I'm thinking of here, Brendan's building on some things that Jason was saying. Like, I mean, we think of legacy cities as, you know, places that peaked, you know, a long time in the past, and a problem that's as old as the legacy cities themselves in some senses. But, you know, we looked into just a couple metrics of kind of decline or what might characterize a legacy city. It came up with, you know, population past peak, median household income past peak, and household vacancy rates elevated. And, you know, found that there's actually a lot of the country that peaked in the 2010s. Or we found, 215 legacy counties overall, about a little over 40% peaked in the 2010s. These are places like North Carolina's Furniture Belt, that where it really was a foreign competition, I think, yeah, post trade liberalization with China affecting the industry there. Places like kind of the west of Chicago, there along the Chicago-Wisconsin border, Rockford, Illinois, and DeKalb County, and all places like that have since fallen on pretty hard times. But those have been pretty recent. And our flagship policy effort is really trade adjustment assistance, which is kind of some paltry money for retraining and programs that aren't, you know, particularly recognized to be very good at helping people find jobs. And that money doesn't go towards making sure that there's a new entity there to provide the jobs. So I think that question again of what comes next in these places, you know, it can't be engineered by a benevolent bureaucrat, of course, but no, we haven't spent that much time on it. And then, yeah, in the past, I think policy was pretty hands-off. You know, it was either we don't want to meddle in the free market, or, you know, trade liberalization is paramount here. And, you know, it assumed that adjustment would occur underneath. And I think we saw that adjustment does not occur left on its own, especially in these places that were really dominated by particular industries. And so we're hoping now, and at EIG thinking about the next big transition is probably going to be something induced by the climate crisis, right? So that's going to affect all sorts of different industries, not just energy production, but I think really have unforeseen consequences. And how do we get ahead of that wave, since we kind of whiffed on helping places survive what happened to domestic manufacturing? Yeah. I don't have answers there yet either.
No. They're good questions, and lots of places kind of grappling with those sorts of issues. I want to come on to, you know, some of your thinking around, you know, that place-based approach, which you're in favor of. But before we do that, Jason, as part of your, you know, your fellowship, you know, you've written a little bit about the politics of legacy cities, the politics of deindustrialization. Obviously, you've been writing about that at a time when the US was electing its new president. Just say a little bit more around that, because I think, again, you know, the notion of the blue collar worker and who speaks for the blue collar worker and the blue collar place is obviously relevant, particularly relevant in the US, but hugely relevant in the UK in the same ways. You know, which party speak to the blue collar worker, the blue collar place. And we've had a similar sort of switch, I suppose, in some respects between our two main parties as to, you know, who does that. So just say a little bit more about, you know, about some of the work that you've been thinking about there, or some of the writings that you've been doing.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating topic. And in addition to being fascinating, I think it's incredibly important, you know, for the future of the country and how we do public policy and how, you know, both of our political parties evolve and change and what that means for the health of our democracy or for our economy. And I think, I read a lot of the national media, probably too much, and I don't want to trash the national media too much because there are plenty of good things that are written that I think are very accurate. But I think it is fair to say that there has been a trend of, I think, not really taking the time to understand voters or places in this part of the country. And very quick things are written, you know, through the lens sometimes of the person in the stereotypical coastal city only. And so, like, what I've seen on the ground here in Ohio is there truly has been a shift of traditional Democratic blue-collar voters shifting to, say, in 2016, of course, to Trump, but even more broadly, I think, to the Republican Party. But I think we're in this kind of weird way station where I would argue there's not necessarily a party of the working class right now. And you know, I used in one blog post I wrote on my own blog, like my grandparents as an example. I mean, they were probably as anti-Republican as you can imagine. They, you know, both were factory workers, my grandfather and grandmother. And I'm sure they would have voted for Trump if they were still alive. And that's the kind of shift, I think. And I think sometimes with, you know, the states that swung, like most notably Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin that had traditionally voted blue for a long time, I do think that that is a real trend. But on the other hand, I don't think, you know, I haven't seen too much evidence the Republicans actually are doing anything that substantive to help the working class. And so, but I would argue the Democrats certainly, I think both in tone and somewhat in substance, have lost a lot of their, I guess you would say, their street cred for helping the working class too. So I do think we're in this very novel and interesting and I would say somewhat fraught moment of, I think there's something's got to give on that, you know, yin and yang between those two parties. And I don't know what it will be or how it will happen, but I think a lot of the political volatility that you're seeing in the country, one of the roots of it, you know, there are other roots, but one of the roots of it, I think, is this kind of vying back and forth of like, well, who is going to represent us for a lot of people in places like Ohio? And I don't think people know the answer to that yet.
And your thoughts on, you know, reflections on that, you know, the sort of the national politics, national representation?
Yeah, it's definitely a voting block that's up for grabs. But yeah, to some extent, Jason's definitely right that something has to give eventually. But like right now, the working class is trending hard Republican, like far as we can tell. That might change with under a Biden administration and what they deliver. But we looked into Pennsylvania, which is kind of a classic Rust Belt state, but it bridges the East Coast and the Great Lakes region. It has Philadelphia, of course, and Pittsburgh on the west, and it's pretty rural in the middle. But looked into some detailed voting patterns data there over the past couple election cycles. And we really saw a rapidly strengthening relationship, not just between whether a place was metropolitan or not, but whether a place was predominantly white collar worker or blue collar worker. And, you know, this trend line is getting steeper, meaning people are sorting more and more along kind of, I think, new class lines, really, especially as both parties devolve into identity politics. Class lines where predominantly white collar, you know, voters who often live in metropolitan areas is given where white collar jobs are, and often in the kind of the central city counties of those metropolitan areas are starkly trending one way, and then folks who live in more rural, where blue collar work is more plentiful, and just smaller cities in general are trending hard Republican. And that continued through the 2020 election cycle. If it keeps up in 2024, I think is anyone's guess at this point. Well, we'll see. The answers have not yet been coming from Washington, and I think this voting bloc is pretty astute in recognizing that.
It's a really interesting dynamic, because I think we see some similar trends in the UK. So as you say, you have this sort of geographical, you know, difference, you know, urban, particularly inner urban, yeah, question versus, you know, semi-rural or rural sort of element. And then cutting across that, or within that, you have this kind of super educated or relatively, you know, highly educated versus those that are less educated. In some instances, the geography and the education fits together, but in other instances, it doesn't quite. But it's kind of interesting debate around those sorts of issues.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, education is not just getting a credential, it's socialization, right? Going through campus life and all is socialization, just as, you know, your workplace socializes you as well. So I think that kind of the divergent educational trajectories are leading to kind of divergent socialization patterns, which just further kind of deepen the identity rifts that I hope are able to bridge soon. I think people are tired of it and looking for something new, but what they are uniting around next is an open question.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to, you know, to thinking about what the emerging policy agenda is, I suppose, for legacy cities. Jason, again, in some of your writings, you know, I think you had two blogs where you talked to a bunch of people, you know, you'd interrogated them and, you know, asked them all the tough questions, get the answers out of them. And then you had a bunch of themes and issues that you were beginning to express. But then you also wrote about, I suppose, framing that, which is a kind of skeptical, real world skepticism, really, of this kind of managed decline or smart decline, or, you know, bet smaller is better. People use different phrases for it. You're pretty skeptical about that just from a real world perspective. So give us your skeptical take on that. And then we'll get into the, so what can we do then? What's the limits of our possibility, or what, you know, where can we go next? So why smart decline, why it's not such a great idea?
Sure. And I think that what came through that series of posts that you referenced, and I'll add one more item in that is, I think, related very much to smart decline, or maybe even is the root cause of the philosophy of smart decline, is this, and Kenan could probably speak to this more from some of EIG's other work, but is this like tension between, do we need policies that just help people, or do we need policies that help place? And of course, we all want to help people. And I'm the first to say, I would never argue that no one should move. I think some things I've written, people have caricatured as I'm saying everyone needs to be, you know, bound and gagged and kept in their hometown. And that's not at all the case. But I think that there has been this kind of, you know, like lurking in the ether of the public policy discussion for a long time, has been like almost this general idea that there are parts of the country that just need to kind of get shut down. And I think, you know, some of that's manifested itself, like you said, Andrew, with managed decline, you know, at a city level, say like Detroit was a good example of where that was kind of being toyed with. But I think the disconnect has always been, even if you could mothball Youngstown or Detroit, they're part of a region, and the suburbs often are fairly prosperous, or at least doing much better than the city. And these are huge urban regions. I mean, in the case of Detroit, you know, we're talking 4.5-5 million people in the area around Detroit. And like Kenan has talked about, none of these areas on a national scale are doing that well. And the idea that you can just start to write off entire swaths of the country, I think in addition to being foolish, is just, it will never happen. And I think what it will do is exactly what we've seen over this last decade, is will cause social and economic tension. It will cause volatile elections that are very contentious and acrimonious. And it will cause, most worryingly to me, like large swaths of our citizenry to start to lose faith in our political system or our economic system. And I think that actually crosses the line from, you know, just unhelpful to borderline dangerous and alarming. And so I think not only, you know, my argument would be not only should we be helping these places to do better than manage decline, just for helping the people that live there, which is hugely important, but I think we're actually helping, you know, all of the American people by trying to lift up these parts of the country. And the other thing I'll just add in closing is, I'm certainly speaking for myself. I'm not asking for like special treatment for Ohio, or, you know, that we should be, you know, things should be done here with public policy that aren't done other places. And I think a lot of these trends, it's not necessarily someone's fault for why these things happen, but they did happen. The economy certainly did get much weaker here compared to other parts of the country. And I think in a, you know, if we're going to want to have a broad-based prosperity in this country, which I think we should have, I do think we have to deal with it and not just put our head in the sand and kind of almost hide behind academic theories like managed decline.
And we'll come back. I noted when I was reading your, you know, the various bits that you've written, it's an interesting one in a sense. You're certainly not advocating for, you know, special dispensation or special status, but you are definitely arguing for a more differentiated and a more granular understanding of the nature of the challenge. And you use housing as an example, where often housing is talked about as being a very, you know, we've got so many people, house prices and rents are going ever upwards. It's a, you know, it's an issue of affordability. And you actually say some of our cities have got a different challenge of affordability. They've certainly got issues around quality. They've got relations around dilapidation and dereliction that we need to deal with. So even within the so-called same policy field like housing, it does differentiate itself. And if we don't appreciate that, we can't really figure out how to deal with them.
Right. And I think that might be a partial manifestation of what Kenan mentioned about even, you know, how people are socialized, or certainly where they live or what their educational level is, that I think that it gets back into what we were talking about earlier on the podcast of, you know, you have a certain perspective of people who live in cities, to your point, Andrew, where those are very real issues of out of control real estate prices, or middle class people being priced out, you know, having to commute 50 miles to get to work. But I think where the disconnect comes in that isn't so helpful for a place like Akron is, those issues just get overlaid without any nuance. And as you said, quite often are the opposite problem. You know, if you want to drive, if you want to get to where you have the cheapest real estate prices, you're going to have the shortest drive, not the longest in Akron. You know, you're going to live closest to downtown. And so I just think that it, just like the managed decline or some of the other things, it's where maybe a narrative by often well-intentioned people who are trying to understand cities, it's a square peg that gets tries to get pounded into the round hole of the reality of a place like Akron or Cleveland.
Kenan, if sort of smart decline or managed decline is not the option, or is not, you know, is not the appropriate option, how should we begin to build a frame for thinking about what can be done, or what should be done? What are beginning to be the kind of building blocks of policy that we begin to put in place?
Yeah, so I mean, we're thinking about just what tools can you add to the toolbox? Like, you know, how can we help Jason in his job as a urban planner and a couple other development director for the city of Akron? What tools can we give him to do his work and just help kind of create brighter future, economic future organically for the city of Akron, not just the suburbs and the whole metro area? So, I mean, some examples there. So one thing that we're excited about, it's in Biden's part of the Biden agenda. It will likely become part of, if we pass anything on immigration reform, it may be a pilot program in that. This idea that we've advocated for is called Heartland Visas. And that's getting essentially place-based visas where you allow, so say a city like Akron that knows that, you know, it has what, Nepali immigrant population, is that right? Yeah, Jason. And yeah, just like many other cities throughout the Rust Belt, like Turks in Dayton, I think various Indian communities up in upstate New York and elsewhere, you know, all these legacy cities and many others behind have success stories of immigrant-led revitalization where they have new entrepreneurs who start new business that, you know, becomes a new employment anchor or they even just, you know, there was a dilapidated street corner that's now kind of a mini, immigrant enclave of all sorts of like tasty food and locally owned shops. And it's revitalizing the corridor. And it's helping shore up municipal budgets. It's helping, you know, fill school rooms, et cetera. And just putting a place on a more stable footing and stronger trajectory. So why not, as we're doing immigration reform, come up with a new way to enter the United States that allows places, you know, suffering from population decline, and have, roll out the welcome mat to immigrants from abroad to be part of their economy, you know, work for their small and medium enterprises, not just, you know, have a visa attached to one particular employer or what have you. And we think that's a good example of something where kind of it's voluntary to use, but it's an extra tool in the toolbox form of, just getting people who want to be in your community there and contributing. Another one, I don't know if opportunity zones have come across the pond and you guys have heard of those some, but have you guys heard of opportunity zones that entered the UK?
Yes, we have.
Yeah, so EIG was really involved in kind of conceptualizing that idea, and we've been kind of keeping track of the success stories throughout the country. And there are some emerging, especially in Erie, Pennsylvania, which is probably just, 50 miles from Akron, Ohio, where, you know, it's created a new kind of investment vehicle for kind of local wealth to be rechanneled locally if some other institutions are there to make it happen. Like they have a strong downtown development corporation, they have a big anchor employer who was able to put money into a fund to kind of invest locally, because so much of our financial system has been globalized, right? It was really easy to take money from Erie and just put it anywhere in the world. Yeah. It was a lot harder to kind of just have an incentive to reinvest in Erie instead. And opportunity zones, I think in its best form, can help provide some of those channels. And, you know, there some money is investing in what, downtown redevelopment, a cybersecurity startup, a big recycling plant, taking advantage of the location on the water and all. And, you know, that's a new tax incentive tool. That's a federal tool. So it's not eroding the local city budget or anything that community has found a way to take advantage of. There are other ones. I don't think that Akron, for example, has had much opportunity zone activity happening, and a lot of other legacy cities haven't yet. So it's not a fail-safe tool at all. And there are lots of, we can have a whole podcast on what we've learned through the opportunity zones experiment so far. But the point is, example of a new tool in the toolbox in a way that we should be experimenting with. How do we kind of disrupt the current kind of patterns of growth and even just challenge assumptions? You know, people don't expect, left alone without a prompt, a lot of people aren't going to expect to be able to find a strong economic return even over really long time horizons in a legacy city. But if you can tweak the incentive some and challenge them to actually think about it and actually try to be part of a decision pattern that may make it happen, you get different behavior. So some examples. Yeah. And then I think just last thing I'll say is being a little more conscious about just abstract things like competition policy, how that really affects places. And here, I think airline industry speaks to me because I went to high school in Cincinnati, Ohio, the other corner of the state from Jason, where, you know, back when I was there, we had, it was a hub for Delta. We had flights all over the United States, I think 400, 500 a day, flights to London, to Paris, everywhere. It really put Cincinnati kind of on the map. It was a corporate decision that made that happen. Of course, Delta decided to put their hub there, but then they also decided to take it away when they merged with another airline. And our airlines are extremely concentrated in the United States now. So all of a sudden, you know, Cincinnati just went from that hyper connectivity that is a key ingredient of a successful advanced metropolitan economy today, just took it away in a flash. And thankfully they've been able to like retain one, they're really big anchor employers like Procter & Gamble, which is our answer to Unilever, the giant global consumer goods giant and all. They've been able to maintain some of their competitive advantages, but it makes it a lot harder to just deprive a place of essential infrastructure, which essentially are very laissez-faire, like, oh yeah, we can just have four big airlines approach had. And I think what we're advocating for, a little more thought into what are the repercussions of some of these seemingly technocratic or just macroeconomic decisions on places, which we haven't had a good appreciation of for a while.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating area around, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of that, but you can imagine that in aggregate, the decision made may well have been the kind of right decision, as it were. And I use right, you know, loosely, but actually it has very, very concentrated impacts on certain localities or certain industries. I mean, this is part of the story you were talking about in terms of, you know, the manufacturing effect, you know, the effects on manufacturing opening up to China, that, you know, there's been quite a few studies done on that and the very regionalized impact that that has had on certain parts of the US economy relative to, even if the aggregate, it was a, you know, it was a good thing to do. It's a good reminder that we have to think about the spatial implications of decisions that may well make sense at the macro level. Jason, what other tools are part of the, you know, the toolbox, as it were, that Keenan was beginning to sort of lay out for legacy cities? What are where's your thinking now, that things that we, you know, we need to push on, we need to do more on, you know, we need to get these things happening?
I think that at the legacy city level, and I'll put my planning director hat on a little bit more, you know, the local leadership part is critically important. You know, I would argue, and I'll explain this a little bit more, that it's necessary. It's absolutely necessary, but not sufficient. So if you have a legacy city and you don't have strong, you know, competent leadership, I think that there's almost no outside interventions that will help you. I think in some cities that maybe are, I won't name any names, but some superstar cities that are so desirable right now, I think you can have pretty poor local leadership and still muddle through just because of the strength of the economy, but you can't get away with that here. So I think having, you know, local leaders that understand public policy and understand their residents are critically important. You know, one thing we did here in Akron, just as a local policy intervention, is we did create a citywide 15-year residential property tax abatement program. And it's not a silver bullet, but it has been incredibly impactful. You know, we're, for the first time in a decade, we're getting significant amounts of new housing built as a result of that incentive. Our median sales price in the city went from $56,000 in 2015 to $101,000 in 2020. And although the program itself, I'm sure, didn't do all of that, I think it was responsible for some of that increase. And I think decisions about, you know, infrastructure and public services, I think in today's day and age, people are mobile. They if you don't provide good city services, they don't have to stay. They will, you know, especially people of means. And, you know, if we're looking to have a tax base or people who might have more social capital, I think it's important to attract and retain those residents. But the other thing, and this builds on what Kevin was saying, I think this is where the necessary but not sufficient comes in. But we do need, you know, national public policy and state policy, I think, that strengthens and supports the local efforts. And just one more example, I mean, banking is a great example. I mean, when I was a kid, I'm pretty sure in the United States, it was still illegal for banks to even cross state lines. And, you know, that was undone in the name of deregulation. And while there were probably some good reasons, you know, maybe those regulations were a little bit too restrictive, but I think the pendulum swung the other way. And we don't even have a local bank in Akron anymore. You know, we had several banks headquartered here when I was a child, and our last big bank, First Merit, was bought by Huntington a couple of years ago. And so they're in Columbus, but even just being 2 hours away in Columbus, it's not the same thing as having the bank president, you know, being the person who grew up, you know, hobnobbing with other people in the community, or I know these are cliches, but coaching Little League or whatever. But it like a lot of banking, especially banking to help lower income people get loans for mortgages or small entrepreneurs to get business loans, it is who you know a lot of times. And so I think when the bank is this more faceless entity that's located farther away, and we could go on and on, newspapers, you know, there are all sorts of other things that have consolidated, like Kenan mentioned with airlines. But I think, you know, state and federal public policy that can start to recognize that some of these decisions that might sound efficient, they do have like a human cost here on the ground, especially in smaller cities.
Do you see that happening, you know, in sort of federal, you know, federal government considerations and decisions? Because it's a similar conversation that, you know, we're having in the UK in some ways, which is about, you know, almost, you know, do you have a kind of a weighting in the decision-making criteria for the impact on place and particularly, you know, the impact on places? If you can see that decisions in the aggregate, actually, they are the downsides are very spatially concentrated, or they have very spatially concentrated implications, you know, that should have a greater weight in the decisions that are ultimately made. And that's a live conversation, I think, in the UK. Is it similarly so in the US? I appreciate it's much, you know, it's difficult. You're a much bigger country, much more, you know, devolved, much more federal than we are, much more of a unitary government. But I mean, just give me a sense as to where that is.
Yeah, I'll jump in on this one. So it is, what springs to mind is our antitrust conversation right now, where there's a whole kind of stream of generally left-leaning progressive economists who are just want us to think of, you know, not just think of the cost of products in our antitrust conversations, but think of impacts on workers as well, and also on places. And there, I mean, I think when you take it to its logical extreme, like if this merger will lead to this factory town shutting down, should it not proceed? I think it's actually hard at a national level to say, no, it shouldn't proceed because of that. But I do think that asking the question would help figure out, you know, some better supports to aid that community in surviving that transition. I use that as a case in point to challenge myself as well. I instinctually really wanted to get in the way, but I think it probably shouldn't. Otherwise, what are we doing? The economy needs to evolve. But to some of what Jason was saying earlier, you know, if you have a metropolitan region of 4 million people in Northeast Ohio or in Detroit, like that has incredible inherent capacity for renewal, right? That's just a lot of economic actors making a lot of decisions with a lot of money and a lot of potential. So yeah, I think we should all be challenging ourselves to just try to think through what might be getting in the way of that renewal happening naturally. So I think, you know, some of the credit markets and like banking stuff that you mentioned is possible. And there are all sorts of things that you could look at as well. One thing that on the banking that just was in the Biden stimulus package that passed Congress yesterday is a program called the State Small Business Credit Initiative, which, you know, counteracts, you know, the extreme imbalance in venture capital funding in this country. I think 75 to 78%, depending on the year, of all venture capital is kind of sequestered in Massachusetts, New York, and California. That leaves very little for the rest of the country to kind of finance the growth startups. But this program, it gives pretty generous funding. No, it's $10 billion to states to allocate, you know, to high growth, high potential companies. And that's a nice federal way, I think, to correct for some gaps in the market naturally without being too interventionist, I think. So yeah. That program had some good success back when it was piloted in the early 2010s. And it's really great that they just renewed it again here to help aid from the pandemic recovery. So
that's really interesting. I want to close by getting your reflections on, you know, the big issue. Obviously, we're talking now in March 21, you know, we've had 12 months, if not a little bit longer, of a pandemic, which has been catastrophic for our, you know, for the globe, but it's certainly been catastrophic for our economies and in many respects for our urban areas because of the nature of the virus itself, but also then what we've had to do on the policy response side. So it's a big question, which the answer in part, I suppose, it's a bit too early to tell, but I mean, Jason, just start from your view. I mean, where does the pandemic leave a place like Akron in the short term, I suppose, and in the medium and longer term? In a sense, you know, what's happened? Have things gone backwards over the last 12 months? And then what does that tell you about where you go in the next 12 months, 24 months, you know, 5 years? Just give us your summary on that.
Sure. I guess I'll start with budget, you know, just with my role in the city that we were incredibly concerned last April, you know, once it really became clear the extent of the pandemic, what this would do to our tax receipts and our budget. And although we did take a hit in 2020, it ended up not being nearly the hit that we were afraid of. And I don't know that that's been repeated in every city, but I may have partly been the degree to which people did work from home, that can work from home, which is, I think, you know, people exaggerate how many people that is. Most people don't. But many businesses did muddle through I think where we saw the impact, like physically or visually, the most is downtown. You know, downtown, there were a lot of businesses starting up and new restaurants, and they took, you know, retail has been pretty awful. Housing actually stayed strong through the whole pandemic here, actually improved even. And so I think in the short term, you know, other than, of course, the, you know, terrible, you know, death and illness that has happened in addition to a lot of people suffering economically, I think in the end, you know, we'll make it through. I would never argue that the pandemic has been a good thing. Of course, it hasn't. But I don't know that we necessarily took some of the dramatic hits that some other markets have. And I think in the longer term, you know, it is, and oh, one other thing I'll say, just being in this part of the country, I mean, for good or for bad, cities like Akron have been used to, you know, no one's used to a pandemic, don't get me wrong, but things being disrupted or not working well, we've kind of been dealing with disruptions for a long time. And I think there is maybe a little bit of like psychological resilience here because of that. Longer term, I mean, I'm optimistic, or at least hopeful, that, you know, places like Akron may get a second look. I think maybe some writing has made too much of that. I mean, when I look at like tech relocating from the Bay Area to Miami or Austin, like that's cool. But even if you're talking about other industries, like there's a lot of cities in the US, there's only so many places people are gonna go. But I do think like for people who maybe grew up here and went to New York or something, there might be like, I don't know, like, do I wanna keep paying $4,000 a month is like my quality of life really what I thought? So I think we have some opportunity in a city this size. I don't think it'll be dramatic, but around the margins, it may help give a second look.
Yeah, that's a great response. Kenneth, zoom out, give us the helicopter view. I mean, you know, the economic geography of the US, how will it be affected by, you know, by what comes after the immediate pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, in general, we've seen it accelerate trends that were already underway. So if you're looking at some of the real boom towns of the Mountain West, they've just barely felt a blip. These are places where Californians and, you know, ex-Microsoft and Amazon people from Seattle are moving. And they also now dominate the national conversation about what the pandemic means for small town America. It's like not every place is at the foothill of the Rockies and the doorstep of the national parks. So those that are, I think, are really benefiting from the pandemic and kind of the shift to remote work, some of which will remain permanent. But we've also, I mean, we actually just released some data earlier this morning that shows that, so take the legacy cities of the Rust Belt. About half of them are doing fine and half of them are really struggling. And many of them didn't recover the jobs that they lost from the Great Recession. The holes that the pandemic has dug are really deep and they may not recover from all the jobs lost to the pandemic recession either. Here I'm thinking some places, and maybe Detroit, like their leisure and hospitality employment is down farther than Las Vegas's. Buffalo, you know, some of these cities are going to have a really hard time, I think, because they just were barely getting by before. And I think they hadn't really stabilized like a place like Akron have and Cleveland have. Other legacy cities, you know, they're doing really well, especially if they're kind of at the national crossroads of distribution networks and things like that, like Indianapolis and St. Louis and other unfamiliar city names to our UK listener base. So I think that all in all, though, the pandemic may provide a really useful service in helping to rebalance our economic geography, because no one could look at what was going on in the 2010s and say that this is an equilibrium and this is sustainable. I think it's the same for you guys in the UK. So the fact that, you know, we were just blindsided by this economic shock may help the pieces fall into place a little more optimally on the outside, where just more places have deeper human capital pools and more kind of inroads to growth than did before. I think that can only be useful.
So that's a great way to finish. And for listeners who want to find out more information about the Legacy Cities program, where do they go, Kenan?
EIG.org/legacycities.
Brilliant. My guests today have been Jason Segedy and Kenan Fickrey. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being part of City Talks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter @Centre for Cities, or like us on LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.